On behalf of Sunstone, we welcome you to this afternoon session of the Theological Symposium. Today we'll be hearing from Sam Taylor and a response from Ron Esplin. Sam will discuss a paper entitled Never Friends, Brigham Young and John Taylor. Sam is the grandson of John Taylor. His father was John W. Taylor, the Mormon apostle. I was just talking with Sam. I'm trying to buy the John W. Taylor house on Quinn Street, but Sam informs me that he wasn't born there, really doesn't know the house, but he grew up in a house in Provo that was won in a poker game. In fact, Sam is one of Mormonism's colorful personalities, legendary, perhaps a holdover from a generation that many of us younger people will never experience. Perhaps a generation of people, for example, J. Golden Kimball and B.H. Roberts, and maybe people like Hugh Nibley, outspoken types who didn't subordinate individual expressionism to the principle of conformity. And it's fortunate that we have some of these people left, people that knew some of the first generation Utah pioneers. So we're very, very happy that Sam was able to come and present this paper from California. Of course, Sam has been the author of numerous books. Nightfall at Nauvoo was a book I read for the first time last summer, and certainly one of the more interesting reading experiences I had last year. Several other books regarding the Taylor family history. Ron Esplin is one of a core of church-employed historians, formerly worked for the now non-existent History Division, and now employed by the Joseph F. Smith Institute for Church History, which is now at BYU. Ron received his PhD in history from BYU, and as a specialty has studied the life of Brigham Young. So first we'll hear from Sam Taylor, and then the response by Ron, and perhaps if we have some time we can entertain some questions as well.
I'm amazed. I've been to a number of writers' conferences, and on the last day everybody packs up and goes home. I had a boiler room going, calling people I knew to get a clack in here. And I'm glad that we had a response. Now, in case there are any Mormons in the audience, I want to save you from shock and disillusionment and embarrassment if you happen to catch me in some lunch counter having a cup of coffee, because I have a permit. And this is a very valuable thing. I keep it in a my wallet, copy. Encased in plastic, and the original is in my safe at home. And it's a prescription from the Permanente Medical Group of Redwood City, which says that Samuel Taylor should have coffee when needed. And so I need it generally about 10 in the morning, 3 or 4 in the afternoon. I couldn't find any in the hotel. but, of course, I hate the awful stuff, but I take my medicine like a man. At any rate, I'm happy to be here because it gives me a chance to read, and I'm very poor at it. So, an opportunity to practice. I hope you'll bear with me. And just one more thing. I was born in Utah, went to BYU. I've been visiting California for about a half century, but it's good to be home. I don't know what this thing is. It intimidates me. you can't hear, let me know. Now, never friends, Brigham Young and John Taylor. Well, what do we do about this? I can't see. Can you hear now? Okay. The course of empire might have followed different channels, were it not for the deep personality clash between two strong men, Brigham Young and the one who was to succeed him as church president, John Taylor. Back in 1935, I interviewed an old gentleman of 93 at the Alta Club who had known both. He told me of being in President Young's office one morning when John Taylor passed the open door. "Little Bo Brummel," Brigham called mockingly. John Taylor stiffened, turned, and came in. Brigham's sardonic comment was occasioned by the fact that Taylor wore a new spring outfit, striped trousers, jacket with velvet collar, fancy waistcoat, a ruffled shirt with cravat, heavy gold watch chain, cufflinks, and tie clasp. In contrast, Brigham Young dressed plainly. In the New England of his early life, when a young man reached 21, he received a pair of sturdy boots and an overcoat, and these were expected to last him the remainder of his life. During his 30-year reign in Utah, Brigham never ceased railing at the foolish frills of fashion. However, a signal failure in a remarkably successful career was his attempt to persuade the women to adopt a Deseret costume and all dress alike. Stopping before Brigham's desk, John Taylor said, "President Young, I sustain you in the office, in your office as prophet, seer, and revelator. But," he added, "I despise you as a human being." Then, with a curt, "Good day, sir," he turned on his heel and marched out. Brigham grinned and again resumed conversation with my informant, who told me that this was typical of the manner in which the two men said good morning. For reasons I cannot fathom, the long-standing tension between John Taylor and Brigham Young has been completely suppressed. I would think that if two men cordially disliked each other during a period of some four decades, yet continued to work together, recognizing the value of each other's contribution in tilling the Lord's vineyard, that this is a faith-promoting situation that should be widely recognized. Wouldn't it help people who drift away from the faith for trivial reasons? Dislike of an authority figure, personality clash, backbiting gossip, a slighter affront. However, there is small hope of changing the official stance on such matters, and I wouldn't be too surprised to see someday a positive thinking approach to the subject, such as an article entitled "Brigham Young and John Taylor, The Story of a Beautiful Friendship." We've already had the piece, "John Taylor, upholder of law and order, about a man who defied federal law, going underground rather than to obey it, directing a church while in hiding for 2.5 years, and who died of the price on his head. We don't know the origin of the tension between Brigham and Taylor. However, it isn't necessary to explain enmity between cats and dogs. Except for religious faith, the men had nothing in common and had entirely different value systems. John Taylor was an intellectual, a writer and editor with deep appreciation for the arts. Known as champion of rights, he held respect for the individual dignity and freedom of every soul. In contrast, Brigham Young was a practical man who believed that the individual should subordinate freedom to the building of the kingdom. An example is the charade of public elections in Utah during his regime. Everyone voted correctly because of the numbered ballot. Each vote could be checked. It is no disservice to Brigham to say that he wasn't an intellectual. He was tremendously shrewd, but took pride in scorning fancy talk. He openly ridiculed intellectuals and warned against learning, book learning, except for the scriptures and other books. All novels, scriptures and faith promoting effusions, all novels and most other books were Satan's trap for the unwary. And we certainly have abundant record of his derision of professional men, particularly doctors and lawyers. He had attended school a total of 11 days and had never read a book in his life. He misspelled his own name on his first marriage license, though improved in this regard with practice. Taylor considered him a Philistine and winced at his broad humor, considering it crude and uncouth. Brigham never understood Taylor's pixie witticisms, his oblique English drollery, his subtle satire. During banquets and social functions at the Mansion House in Nauvoo, Taylor always finished off the evening with jokes, one-liners, and roasts. These cracked up the guests except for Brigham, who was never sure whether Taylor was praising him or giving him the needle. Another factor causing tension between them was rivalry for church position. The Quorum of the Twelve weren't the all-powerful hierarchy at Nauvoo that the Twelve is today. While Brigham outranked Taylor in the Twelve, this wasn't a vital factor during Joseph Smith's lifetime. John Taylor was a close friend of Joseph, one of a small circle of intimates. Joseph was immensely popular. He knew everyone, while thousands idolized the prophet. But he had very few intimates. Taylor and Joseph had much in common as spiritual men, mystics, attuned to the unseen, and as seekers with questing minds. The two loved to sit together of an evening with a glass of good wine and enjoy the stimulation of each other's company. Both, despite only a few years of formal schooling, were self-educated and shared a passionate love of knowledge. Joseph also had a lively sense of humor and a love of horseplay, which unfortunately has been almost entirely erased from our history. And in this, he and Taylor had a common bond. At Nauvoo, John Taylor was very influential in civic affairs. He, with Joseph Smith and William Law, were called by John C. Bennett the Holy Trio who ran the city. By contrast, while Brigham Young had tremendous affection for the province, he and Joseph, and though Joseph thought well of his abilities, the two men weren't close friends. Brigham was never one of the prophet's circle of intimates. This was perhaps fortunate. In his book, Brigham Young, M.R. Werner observed, if Brigham Young had spent all his days as right-hand man of the prophet at Nauvoo, sooner or later, there would have been a conflict, for their personalities differed so much. The antagonism between Taylor and Young was firmly established as early as 1840, when Taylor had been in the church only 4 years. They and others of the 12 were on a historic mission to the United Kingdom, making converts by the thousands and transporting them at incredibly low fares in chartered ships and riverboats to the gathering of the saints at Nauvoo. One man alone, Wilford Woodruff, converted more than 8,000 souls during this mission. From Liverpool, Taylor wrote Brigham at London on 19 April, requesting that his wife, Leonora, join him. She was well acquainted at Liverpool, and I am proposing, before I leave, visiting the Isle of Man, of which place she is a native and has many friends. This fact would help the missionary work, while in addition, Leonora's health was poor in fever-ridden Montrose across the Mississippi from Nauvoo. Brigham vetoed this request, although he had approved letting the wife of another man, Parley Pratt, join him in England. Leonora never in her lifetime saw the Isle of Man again. Taylor was smarting from this rebuff when he wrote to Willard Richards on 4 May regarding compilation of a hymn book. These two, together with Parley Pratt and Brigham Young, were supposed to meet as a committee, each with a suggested list, and make final selections. Instead, Brigham had simply made his own list. I would feel obliged if Elder Young would favor me with his views on this subject, Taylor wrote stiffly. After this protest, the committee did meet, but Brigham's selections predominated. Meanwhile, Taylor was preparing to publish an edition of the Book of Mormon. That's the edition we still use. And on 23 July, sent Brigham a page proof that you may judge its appearance. The work was being done by a convert, a very prudent, intelligent man and scholar, employed as compositor for the Liverpool Mercury. It is necessary to be very particular about the proof, Taylor wrote, and then jammed home the needle. I see there are many typographical errors in the hymn book. He suggested that this brother might attend to them, but assured Brigham that in this I shall be guided by what you say. What could Brigham say? That he wanted errors to remain in the hymn book? What he thought is not a matter of record. at Nauvoo, spring of 1844, 4 years later, Brigham and others were off campaigning for Joseph Smith's election as President of the U.S. when the Holy Trio was shattered. William Law defected while Joseph was martyred at Carthage. The new triumvirate became Brigham Young, Heber C. Kimball, and Willard Richards. For the next 33 years, Taylor was the manacle giant, as T.B.H. Stenhouse expressed it, obliged to take counsel from an unfriendly superior. Actually, Taylor and Brigham got along well as long as they weren't too close. With propinquity, the New York Times reported, Brigham says, Taylor was a G.D. son of a bitch and he wished he was rotten in hell. When Utah became too small for both of them, Brigham sent Taylor packing on one mission after another. For a period of 8 years, he scarcely saw his families. Under the circumstances, it is something of a minor miracle that Taylor survived. With the possible exception of Edwin D. Woolley, I am unaware of anyone who remained in good standing while confronting Brigham. And the fact that I descended from both men might explain what's wrong with me. Following the martyrdom of Joseph and Hiram, Taylor joined the majority of the 12 in support of that quorum's claim to church leadership. However, Taylor believed that the 12 should rule as a quorum, that no man could ever take Joseph's place. This also was Brigham's attitude at the time. At the dramatic confrontation of 8 August 1844, when Brigham Young won the people's support, while Sidney Rigdon lost his own bid for power, Brigham chided Sidney for supposing that any man could ever replace Joseph. As time passed, however, Brigham wanted to become president of the church, not merely of the 12. During the exodus from Nauvoo, when the Saints bivouacked at Winter Quarters, Nebraska, to await spring before embarking across the plains for a destination at that time unknown, two incidents did little to endear the two men to each other. The first was a scuffle at a dance over the charms of a cute cupcake named Ann Valentine, sister of Taylor's plural wife, Jane. Men had to pull Brigham and Taylor apart. It didn't help when Ann decided to marry Taylor. Subsequently, when Ann divorced Taylor, Brigham had the last laugh and pocketed the $10 fee for court costs. At Winter Quarters, Taylor offered manly opposition, D.B.H. Stenhouse records, to Brigham's bid to be ordained president of the church, enlisting Orson Hyde and the Pratt brothers, Parley and Orson, in the opposition bloc. It might be merely coincidental that on learning of the joint stock company scandal in the English mission, Brigham dispatched three of the rebels to investigate, Hyde, Parley, and Taylor. The joint stock company was an easy payment plan to finance transportation of converts to America. However, receipts were being absorbed by high living of the men in charge. With this squared away, Taylor presented a petition to Queen Victoria seeking a home for the saints at Vancouver Island. This was rejected by the Crown. Fortunately for me, on this mission, Taylor converted a pretty girl from Birmingham, Sophia Whitaker, and married her on the Atlantic en route to America. She became my grandmother. Taylor and Farley Pratt returned to winter quarters too late to join the pioneer party of Brigham Young's to the Salt Lake Valley. They followed their own company, which comprised the actual pioneers of Utah. Brigham's party was composed of young men. Only three women went along. At the Salt Lake Valley, they put in crops too late to mature as they arrived on 24th July, then skedaddled back for winter quarters. The Pratt-Taylor Company consisted of families, men, women, and children who would actually settle and live in the valley. Ironically, 24 July is a big holiday in Deseret, while the date of the actual pioneers' arrival is forgotten. Returning to winter quarters, Brigham Young was ordained church president 5 December 1847 at a council meeting of the apostles with 8 of the 12 present. Of those who had displayed manly opposition, Farley Pratt and Taylor were in the Salt Lake Valley, and Orson Pratt didn't attend the meeting. Orson Hyde had repented, making the vote unanimous. Perhaps the greatest strain upon the edgy relationship between two strong men came with the failure of the beet sugar enterprise in the 1850s. Taylor had charge of this. He shipped seed ahead from Europe, had sugar machinery built in England, had wagons constructed for hauling it across the plains, and broke wild cattle to the yoke to pull them. He imported experts to set up the factory and run it. The project was dogged with misfortune. Jerry-built wagons broke down. Flour was loaded with plaster of Paris. The sugar train was caught in the mountains by winter storms. But the crowning blow was that after the tremendous effort expended, when the factory was finally set up, sugar couldn't be made from beet juice. After a test run failed, Brigham simply took the project out of Taylor's hands, but Brigham couldn't make sugar either. Anyone who has doubts about the relationship between the two should read the minutes of the meeting where Brigham took control. Taylor was ridiculed and derided before subordinates, and these jackals allowed to tear into pieces. Even Joseph Russell, a very man who had constructed the flimsy wagons that began breaking down the first day of travel. When Taylor tried to defend himself, Brigham threatened to bring charges against him at conference, which would, of course, result in excommunication. So he swallowed his gorge and bowed out of the enterprise. Here we have an example of personal enmity, enmity destroying sound judgment. The complete failure of the projects, coupled with the clash, has caused our historians to treat the sugar enterprise with kid gloves. And it has diverted attention from the real cause of failure. The study of other attempts to make beet sugar in America reveals the incredible fact that over a period of some 75 years, there were 14 beet sugar enterprises undertaken in this country, every single one of which failed because of inability to make sugar. Yet during this period, the manufacture of beet sugar was a commercial success in Europe. Wars had been fought over sugar, and it is obvious that the European refiners simply weren't going to foster American competition. Taylor had been most courteously received by sugar makers at Arras or at the Crespo Delisi refinery, the oldest beet sugar plant in France. The fullest cooperation apparently was given. During 8 months of investigation, the French manufacturers, with the soul of affability, Taylor had no way of knowing, they were holding back minor but essential details of the refining process. In his book, A Saga of Sugar, Fred G. Taylor, no relation, says in those days, and even in the long years that followed, masters of the art of sugar making jealously guarded their secrets from others, particularly from prospective competitors. It is safe to say that knowledge of a few minor mechanical and chemical adjustments would have made the Sugar House project a great frontier success. At this point, we must wonder what might have happened had Brigham and Taylor been friends. Consider this. 26 years later, when the first successful American beet sugar factory was established at Alvarado, California, the secrets of the refining process passed into American hands. Since that time, no American beet sugar factory failed by reason of being unable to produce sugar. And with this in mind, I can't help but wonder at the possibilities had Brigham and Taylor sat down together, faced the fact they had been gulled, and decided what to do about it. The fault was not in the machinery, which was built from the original Crespo Delisi blueprints. It was lack of know-how. Could they have solved this problem with a very potent weapon, the gospel? What if they had countered the swindle with missionary work? In every factory, there is a disgruntled employee. Every beet sugar factory in Europe had men with knowledge of the refining process. No emotion can equal the burning bosom of a convert as he is born again. His loyalty then is to the church, not family, friends, government, or the sugar cartel. To convert just one sugar maker would have made a success of the Deseret Enterprise. Yet, in the heat of the personality clash, this never was considered. The sugar failure rankled as Brigham kept picking the scab off. After being ribbed for 24 years, Taylor was highly sensitive when the matter reached its climax in April 1877 during dedication ceremonies at the St. George Temple. We have legends of heavenly manifestations accompanying this dedication. Though official accounts neglect to mention the most dramatic earthly event, the public clash on the rostrum before some 2,000 astonished and appalled faithful of Brigham Young and John Taylor. In his address, Taylor had goaded a sensitive spot in Brigham by detailing the failure of Young's plan for establishing the United Order, the length and breadth of Mormon country. The order involved pooling of wealth and sharing according to need. A golden chimera dashed time and again on the rocks of human nature. Yet it was primary to the gospel, and Brigham had bent every effort to make it succeed. When he arose to speak, he was steaming. The fact that he rose was something of a minor miracle in itself, for at the time he was incapacitated with arthritis, walking only with difficulty, using both a crutch and cane. In fact, he had been carried around during the conference in an armchair, especially designed for his girth by Howard Cottam. Now, fury gave him strength as he strode to the rostrum and smacked it with his cane so hard that the dents, my spies report, are still there. Brother Taylor, he suggested, should go back to Salt Lake and learn how to build wagons. At this, Taylor sprang to his feet on the stand behind Brigham and suggested, "Why don't you go back to Salt Lake and dig another canal?" This referred to Brigham's irrigation system, an excellent plan with just one flaw. When water was turned into the canal, it refused to run uphill. At this, Brigham keel-hauled him as only Brigham could. This public clash before a packed house came at a time when trouble with the U.S. government was reaching a climax. Just the previous month, John D. Lee had been executed on the nearby site of Mountain Meadows. Offered as a scapegoat in that deplorable affair, after 20 years of trying to keep the lid on it. Also, the crusade against plural marriage had become a public frenzy. With Brigham in poor health, his time on earth obviously brief, it was unthinkable that there should be a public break between the president and the man logically in line to assume the office. In the crisis, the brethren hurriedly assembled and selected Apostle Lorenzo Snow to act as arbiter. Taylor was in no mood to apologize until Snow made him realize that he had been out of order to spring up behind Brigham and interrupt the man at the pulpit. He should have awaited his turn to reply. Realizing the validity of this, Taylor apologized to Brigham. The two shook hands, possibly for the first and last time on this earth. Brigham Young died 4 months later. This, however, didn't settle the relationship. Brigham's spirit seemed to haunt Taylor. First was a matter of succession. While this subject is too involved for discussion at this point, suffice that there were several claimants to the throne. One possibility was that Brigham had laid plans for the continuation of a Young dynasty. Finally, after succeeding as leader of the saints, Taylor was saddled with Brigham's affairs. The acrimonious wrangle over the settlement of Young's estate became so bitter that one heir actually was excommunicated posthumously. It is doubtful, moreover, that in the 10 years that he survived Brigham, Taylor ever felt free of a man's sharp and critical appraisal of his actions, particularly when he replaced Brigham's benign theocracy with democracy. For example, the abolition of the numbered ballot. In departing this life, John Taylor was firm in the faith. He was prepared to meet his maker. You'll never know whether or not he was prepared to meet Brigham on the other side as a friend. Thank you.
In preparing my comments, I was at a loss to know exactly how to address Brother Taylor, since I'd never met him before. On several occasions when he has been here and I had intended and wished to go, I had other engagements and never had the opportunity, so I'm pleased for this opportunity. I did notice from the Sunstone program that he and I have both consented to be known as Sam and Ron, so I suspect, although others are known by their title or by their full name and initial, Sam and Ron will do here. That still seems presumptuous. I'll probably just call him Brother Taylor. Brother Taylor has focused here on an interesting aspect of an interesting relationship. Before his paper, most of you probably didn't know very much about the relationship between those two pioneer leaders. But I must say, from my point of view, we still don't know very much about how it really was between them or why. The stories of clashes, some of which I accept as basically accurate, several of which I mistrust, and a few of which I simply reject for good cause, which I'll mention in a minute, make for some very spicy retelling, but they do not reveal the parameters of the living relationship between Brigham Young and John Taylor. For me, the view is too simplistic and too stereotyped and too narrow to help us understand what was clearly a much more complex relationship. I remain unconvinced that they had almost nothing in common and that their relationship is anywhere nearly correctly characterized as, quote, 30 years of antagonism firmly established as early as 1840. In fact, I find direct evidence to the contrary in numerous examples that suggest that the whole thing is much more complex. For example, there are some very interesting cases where they defended each other, both publicly and privately. With regard to Brother Taylor, Brigham Young said in conference, I will say that he has one of the strongest intellects of any man that lives. He is a powerful man, he is a mighty man, and we may say that he's a powerful editor. In fact, I will use a term to suit myself and will say that he's one of the strongest editors that ever wrote. That's not to say that Brigham Young here is wholly on John Taylor's side. He concludes by saying, concerning his financial abilities, I have nothing to say. On another occasion, Brigham Young did settle, in fact, what became the settling element in succession when he rearranged the Quorum of the Twelve, of course, to favor John Taylor. And I have here the minutes of that meeting, but I won't take the time to go into that. On still another occasion, according to the clerks in the president's office, John Taylor had given a less than great performance in his morning tabernacle sermon. And people were accustomed to hearing refined and powerful speeches from John Taylor. And apparently there was some grumbling and some disappointment. President Young attended the tabernacle in the afternoon as well and addressed the meeting and remarked that Brother John Taylor was living his religion. He was doing as well as he knew how, and the remarks of Brother Taylor this morning did not convey his true merit and real worth. And I think that's nothing more than a heartfelt defense of his brother and his colleague. The year before this, in private counsel, John Taylor had strongly defended Brigham Young in similar ways. Now this, I'm not suggesting by these few examples that they are an invalidation or that they invalidate Brother Taylor's argument. I merely hold them up as a few examples that I could quickly get my hands on, which suggest that the relationship was complex and multidimensional. Now, I think that within the leading councils of the church, although it's clearly the ideal that we have harmony and unity, it's fairly easy to understand that that ideal is seldom achieved, and that even where it's achieved in support of specific objectives, it comes only after discussion and the airing of strong points of view and ideas by strong-willed and strong-minded men. I don't think we'd have it any other way. A number of factors suggest that while our quorums are made up of mortals and have the challenge of leadership in a mortal context, we'll have grounds for disagreement among the brethren, so to speak. We won't have time to go into these, but I would like to illustrate briefly by saying that, in my view, among the apostles, no one loved the prophet and revered him and his teachings more that is the prophet Joseph Smith, or was more obedient to him than Brigham Young. Yet on several, at least three occasions that I'm aware of, occasions of which there remains records, and perhaps others where there's no record extant, the prophet's decisions tried Brigham Young sorely. Similar, there's no question that Brigham Young's actions on occasion served as a trial to his subordinates. Let me illustrate by the advice of Lorenzo Snow to the young and impatient apostle Heber J. Grant in a Quorum of the Twelve meeting, where Brother Grant complained about some of the proceedings and thought they ought to go another way and expressed his displeasure and his impatience. And Lorenzo Snow got up, now the elder statesman in that setting, and said, "Now, Brigham Young tried some of us as much as anybody can be tried in their feelings in this life. And yet we revered him as a man and loved him and respected him. When those occasions occurred, Brother Grant, what did we do? We did our duty. And what will you do? You will do your duty." So those occasions did occur, and there's simply no question that some of those occasions involved Brigham Young and John Taylor. Such occasions no doubt occurred under each of our pioneer leaders, and probably more often under Brigham Young for several reasons. One, as he said himself at one time, "I have no thoughts but what I freely speak." And I'm sure he was not the most diplomatic about correcting some of his colleagues at some times. In one meeting of the Quorum of the Twelve, where he described what he thought was the proper relationship between himself and them, he said, "And if you get out of the traces, I will put you back." And he was defending his right to interfere even with the apostles if, in his view, and under his priesthood authority, they were not doing what they should. Well, he wasn't timid about exercising his authority in that fashion, and no doubt it offended people at times, as Lorenzo Snow expressed later to Apostle Grant. The point is that John Taylor was clearly on the other side of some of these occasions with Brigham Young, but that illustrating this fact is not necessarily the same as illustrating that Brigham Young and John Taylor never were friends. Orson Pratt and Joseph Smith clashed severely on several occasions. Were they never friends? Orson Pratt and Brigham Young had a running debate for a number of years. Again, were they never friends? What about the time in 1842 when a number of the apostles did not want to readmit Orson Pratt to the Twelve? And Brigham Young strongly defended Orson Pratt and said, "The only thing wrong with Brother Orson is he loved his wife more than Brother Joseph." And that seemed to be forgivable. Or later, when the Quorum of the Twelve had moved to the point where they had almost decided to exclude Orson Pratt, and Brigham Young said, "Lose Orson Pratt to the kingdom? Never. Not a man of Orson Pratt's ability and conviction. Why, Orson Pratt is so much a Mormon that if he were cut in 1-inch pieces, every piece would scream, 'Mormonism is true.'" I just don't believe it's true that Orson Pratt and Brigham Young were never friends, in spite of the great deal of tension that occurred over certain issues over a long period of time. In fact, there's evidence that there was a warm, emotional reconciliation that later in their life, which carried them through embraces and warm friendship that lasted the rest of their life. I don't know if that ever occurred with Brother John. Maybe he had to wait until they could get together on the other side. Maybe John Taylor took to heart the advice Brigham Young gave to the women who would complain of their husbands. "Can't I leave Brother so-and-so? He's just not kind to me." "Endure it, sister. If he lives righteously enough to make it to the celestial kingdom, he'll be refined there. And when you get there, you'll embrace him and love to be with him." So if Brigham made it, Brother Taylor will probably get along with him okay. There are always clashes and potential clashes between firm leaders such as Brigham Young and Joseph Smith, and John Taylor in his turn, I might add, and their strong-willed senior subordinates. And our feelings, I suspect, may go out with the underlings of the moment. And we might feel, if there's blame to assign, that Brigham Young was the one to blame for being overbearing or insensitive. But I should note that contrary to the intimations in the selection of examples in Brother Taylor's presentation, by no stretch of interpretation can all of the examples be laid at Brigham Young's feet as if he were the one to blame for every confrontation. There are examples where, if not Brother Taylor's actions, at least the results of those actions were tremendously burdensome to Brigham Young, and he underreacted and treated it with patience and sensitivity. Now let me be more specific about some of the examples in Brother Taylor's paper. Let me quote, "For reasons I cannot fathom," Brother Taylor wrote, "the long-standing tension between John Taylor and Brigham Young has been completely suppressed." Now I have read much of Sam Taylor's work, and I know that he has a good sense of humor, and you've seen that here today, so he's not likely to be offended if I get personal here. I must say that, quote, for reasons I cannot fathom, unquote, it's become ever more popular to speak of suppressed knowledge and secret documents hidden away. Whenever any action or information is not widely known, or what other people believe does not concur with what we believe. I frankly have difficulty finding any meaning in the word used in the way of in the sentence above. I do find suitable uses for it. For example, in the sentence, quote, I wish Sam Taylor had suppressed the urge to sensationalize this particular point and used the word suppressed in this paper, unquote. I just don't buy the intimations of cover-up and of suppression. Now, if the question really is, why haven't dozens of scholars been telling the world about the Taylor-Young blood feud, I would suggest that, although many of us have long been aware of some of the stories he's related, there's no convincing brief yet in which substantiates the case of a lifelong blood feud, in spite of the clashes which certainly can be documented and illustrated as he has done. So such a proclamation would be premature. I also feel that we can do too much and a disservice, or we can go too far and do a disservice to both John Taylor and Brigham Young by contrasting them as absolutely different kinds of individuals. There's no question they were different in style and in many aspects and substance, but they had many, many things in common. Contrasting John Taylor, the champion of rights who held a respect for individual dignity and freedom of every soul, with Brigham Young, who believed the individual should subordinate freedom to the building of the kingdom, does an injustice to both, because Brigham Young also believed in freedom and dignity of every individual. And John Taylor also believed in subordinating freedom freely by obedience to the kingdom and to the goals and ends of the kingdom. I guess my favorite example of this would be two cases where Brigham Young and John Taylor collaborated in confronting military figures, and they switched roles. In the one case in Nauvoo, John Taylor was the outraged, inflexible, adamant individual who sparked fear in the military leader that the Mormon zealots were out of control. And Brigham Young was a compromising, patient man trying to explain that things were okay and that Brother Taylor has his reasons, and you can see what he's been through. He's been through the smut mill, Brigham Young said. And of course he's a lawless man after what you've done with him. Well, Brother Taylor didn't appreciate that characterization, but the point that they both made allowed them to work out the differences with the military leader. Later during the Utah War, it was Brigham Young who was the inflexible zealot who was going to war for his people, and John Taylor who could meet with Captain Marcy and be urbane and reasonable and flexible in representing the Mormon position. I think they had a lot in common in their attitudes towards the kingdom and what they were willing to do and what they thought was the right thing to do in similar circumstances. Now, going back again to the paper, page 8 says that Brigham Young did outrank John Taylor during the time of Joseph's lifetime, but, quote, this wasn't a vital factor during Joseph's lifetime. To me, it seemed like a tremendously vital factor. As Orson Hyde, for example, found out when he was out of the Quorum in 1839, he sent private messages through Heber Kimball and personal letters directly not to Joseph Smith, but to Brigham Young, the president of his Quorum. And as John Taylor, who could not forget that Brigham Young had ordained him an apostle while Joseph Smith was still in Liberty Jail, that it was under Brigham Young's direction that he received the first temple experience as they stopped in Kirtland in 1839 on the way to Britain, or that it was under Brigham Young as his president that he received his final temple ordinances in the winter and spring of 1844. In fact, Brother Taylor himself tells us a few pages later that Brigham Young refused John Taylor permission to have his wife join him in England. In spite of the fact that Brigham's presidency and outranking was not vital, the refusal stuck, of course. What I'm suggesting is there was a relationship here that began with the ordination of John Taylor as apostle, and Brother Taylor may have occasionally railed against it, but it was part of the reality of his life from the very beginning. By the way, Brother Sam Taylor didn't finish the story of why Brigham Young turned down the request for the wife after approving Parley Pratt's wife coming. The reason he had done that is Parley Pratt had been assigned to retain the presidency or to stay as the president of the mission after the rest of the apostles left. And so John Taylor was safely back with his beloved Lenora in Nauvoo while Parley Pratt remained in Europe with his wife after she arrived. And so there was reason in that. It wasn't arbitrary. It was not vindictive. It was not illogical. Sam says that Brigham Young was never one of the prophet's circle of intimates. Now there I have to strongly disagree, although it's not central enough to the concern here to belabor. Let me just say that there's a pile of evidence of their intimate relationship. and that Brigham Young, as president of the 12 and as a friend and confidant of Joseph Smith, did function as a right-hand man to Joseph Smith, Mr. Werner and Brother Taylor notwithstanding. I understand, however, that this is not well understood, and I do not fault Brother Taylor for not being aware of it. I cannot understand, however, why it's not better understood. All I can conclude is it must have been suppressed. I have a couple of quarrels with the alleged quote of Brigham Young, that sensational quote from the New York Times, using profanity and expletives to describe John Taylor and concluding that Brigham Young wished he was rotten and in hell. Now, there are many things about Brigham Young and the Mormons in the early press that can be directly demonstrated to have been false. Here we cannot easily prove a negative, but you should understand that in the thousands of surviving documents that intimately and in detail that intimately detail the public and private remarks of Brigham Young, including occasionally angry outbursts containing less than refined language, I have never seen the slightest hint that he ever used the Lord's name in vain in that way. It was not part of his nature. Nor have I found the other expletive used. I conclude that this alleged statement of Brigham Young about John Taylor squares neither with Brigham Young's language nor with his sentiment about his colleague, nor even with the relationship Brother Taylor is trying to illustrate, in which he calls at one place cordial dislike. Now, cursing him to hell is not cordial dislike. Then there's the intimation that Brigham Young sent John Taylor on to so many missions abroad because he didn't like him. It may be that President Young yielded to the perfectly human urge to send on important foreign assignments those he was less directly dependent upon at home, as some have suggested before, though this hardly explains why he sent out John Taylor to New York to edit the newspaper, for example. I think in that case Brigham sent him because he wanted the best editor he had, and John Taylor clearly was that. John Taylor, Orson Hyde, did spend a lot of time and may conceivably have been beneficiaries or negative beneficiaries of such a procedure. But that's not convincing to me because it simply doesn't explain the many years away from headquarters of other men such as Lorenzo Snow, Wilford Woodruff, and other colleagues. The fact is that during most of Brigham Young's tenure, the 12 were most needed, he thought, and most often assigned away from the Salt Lake Valley, John Taylor included. Brother Taylor has several of the most acrimonious confrontations between John Taylor and Brigham Young occurring in winter quarters, something I find hard to understand since the two men were almost never in winter quarters at the same time. As Brother Taylor notes, John Taylor was one that Brigham Young sent to England soon after winter quarters was established in the summer of 1846. And so far as I can tell, he was not in the settlement in the winter that Sam would have had him scuffling over with Brigham Young over Ann Ballantyne. The pioneers, in fact, were already pulling out towards the mountains when Taylor and his colleagues returned to winter quarters the next spring. The legend persists, and perhaps because of T.B.H. Stenhouse, who Brother Taylor quotes, that John Taylor, Parley Pratt, and others were opponents in winter quarters of Brigham Young in the discussions that led to the reorganization of the First Presidency in December of 1847. Indeed, Brother Taylor tells us that Brigham Young sent three of the rebels to England, Orson Pratt and John Taylor included. Now that would be interesting indeed, for the discussions did not occur until after the men had returned from the mission to England. So whatever the cause, that clearly was not the cause. In fact, when the discussions occurred, John Taylor and Parley Pratt were already in the Salt Lake Valley and were not present for the discussions. So whatever a manful opposition they put up to Brigham's so-called pretensions, they did by vicarious work. They simply were not there. They would have been there had they followed Brigham Young's counsel on how they prepared themselves immediately upon returning from England, but they were not. I might also suggest that Brother Taylor again follows a widely quoted source, but an incorrect source, in suggesting that Orson Pratt boycotted the meeting where Brigham Young was sustained. The minutes of the meeting show that not only was Orson present, he was the one designated, not perhaps willingly, designated to present the matter for public vote. He was very much there. Again, I would suggest, in Brother Taylor's defense, that these things have been widely misunderstood, partly because the minutes have not been readily available, and people have not known exactly when the debate occurred, or who was present, or what was said. In reference to the Sugar Company, I would like to say more, for this, in fact, is one of the few confrontations where detailed evidence is available. Brigham Young did think John Taylor a poor manager in the affair, But Brother Taylor, I think, is right that John Taylor did not get a fair shake in that discussion. And he's 100% right that the ultimate failure to produce sugar, which Brigham Young never laid at John Taylor's door, that occurred under Brigham Young's management, not Elder Taylor's, could not be laid upon the feet of John Taylor or his colleagues. It was, in fact, the Frenchman's refusal or reluctance to share the secret. And from hindsight, we can see, as Brother Taylor suggested, that they should have gone after somebody with the rest of the formula. I like his what-if speculations, but unfortunately, neither Brigham Young nor John Taylor knew at the time that that was the missing ingredient. So we'll never know what may have happened. May I simply add that after heated discussion and debate in the meeting of 1853 of March, when that confrontation occurred, and there was simply no question of John Taylor's membership. That was not on the line, I don't think. Although I guess if you rebel acrimoniously enough and go stomping out in utter fury, that could ultimately result. The meeting ended with both men putting their arms around each other's shoulders, so to speak, and sharing expressed concerns and feelings that while they disagreed in this, they were still together in the kingdom. We could argue that was a show for the rest of the people in the meeting, but it did end on a different note than the rest of the debate. A final comment on the paper itself. John Taylor replaced Brigham Young's benign theocracy with democracy, writes Brother Taylor. Now, I'd like to write a paper on that, for I firmly believe that the change in atmosphere from a heavy, repressive Salt Lake City under Brigham Young to a relieved and once again free people under John Taylor, something that Sam Taylor plays up with his biography, simply won't hold up with the evidence. And I also believe that John Taylor, in his own personality and in his own way, was as ready to rule by his authority and as firm a believer in priesthood-dominated theocracy as Brigham Young. Indeed, that is precisely the image of John Taylor evoked for me by Sam Taylor's title of the biography, something that fit John Taylor as well as Brigham Young, from whom he borrowed it, The Kingdom or Nothing. In fact, the earliest reference I can find to John Taylor using The Kingdom or Nothing, I will read to you from 1857. In the second epistle of the last verse of the Gospel according to St. Brigham to Colonel Alexander will be found the following words, said John Taylor in conference, "We say it is the kingdom of God or nothing." And I think it characterized aptly both men. Now, I have been specific about the problems I see here. Let me summarize by suggesting what I think the contribution is. While I feel that such phrases as, quote, 30 years obliged to take counsel from an unfriendly superior, unquote, missed the mark, nonetheless, Brother Taylor's paper ought to interest us in examining in more detail a fascinating, and I insist, complex relationship that was on occasion marked by confrontation and strongly held differences of opinion, and which does deserve more full investigation. They were different men in style and personality and background. They were not the warmest of friends. And Brother Taylor may well have made his most important point early in his paper when he said, quote, "I would think that if two men cordially disliked each other during a period of some four decades, yet continued to work together, recognizing the value of each other's contributions in tilling the Lord's vineyard, that this is a faith-promoting situation that should be widely recognized. At least it should be investigated," I would add. That is the same message we find in the delightful anecdote, which I suspect Brother Taylor was alluding to when he talked about his woolly heritage but didn't share with you. As I understand it, there are several versions of this, so he would probably tell it considerably different than I. But if I've got the story right, Brigham Young had been approached by Bishop Woolley for permission to build a dance hall. And Brigham didn't want that. It wasn't that he wasn't in favor of dancing, but he wanted the dancing to occur at the social hall where he could keep his eye on it. He wanted the things out by midnight or 1 o'clock. They had dances late then, and he didn't want any boys chewing tobacco sitting on the fence posts, and he wanted to be right there within a half a block of his house, so he said no. Bishop Woolley invited him some months later to come and dedicate the 13th Ward Assembly Rooms. And Brigham Young came, and he looked around in that setting, and he said, "Brother Woolley, you have deceived me. This is a dance hall." "No," Bishop Woolley defended himself. "This is our assembly room. Here's our pulpit. There's our benches. If you pull that out, this is a dance hall, and you have not done what we talked about." And he stomped off, and eventually Orson Pratt had to dedicate the 13th Ward Assembly Rooms. Well, before he stomped off, the words went a little further, and they had a heated discussion. And finally, Brigham Young says, "Well, Bishop Woolley, I guess you're going to be like the rest. You're going to go off and apostatize." And Bishop Woolley is said to have responded, "Brigham Young, if this..." No, he said, Damned if I will, Brigham. If this was my church, if this was your church, I would. But it's the Lord's church, and it's big enough for both of us. And I suspect that from some of these heated discussions that John Taylor and Brigham Young had, we could gain some of the same lesson, that they decided the kingdom was large enough for both of them. Finally, may I simply say that Brother Sam certainly has the novelist's eye for drama, and he writes superbly. I enjoy his work, and I've read many of his works, even though I sometimes find him straying from the facts as I understand them. I also understand that he has in the past defended himself about this point by indicating that he is, of course, a writer, not a historian, and he's most concerned with painting the larger historical truth than in defending all his details. But I would suggest that even that when writing biography or history or even historical fiction, one should also do all possible to get the facts straight. My own writing is colorless and burdened by poor writing, but I really work on the facts. Perhaps the best and really the only logical course for the two of us is to collaborate.
We'd like to thank these two authors for their papers. We are not only glad that the church is big enough for two individuals such as Brigham and John, but also such as Sam and Ron and their papers, and I'm glad the symposium is open enough that we can invite both of those kinds of approaches. We do have some time, and since both authors are here and the figures that were discussed are so important, I thought you might have some questions. Would the authors be willing to respond to some questions? Okay, why don't you come up, and I see some hands already, so let's take some questions for maybe 10 minutes or so.
Well, it is extant, yes, and been a lot published. I think I should say that much of the material I give you is rejected by the establishment, and here's the author of the beautiful friendship piece that I said is inevitable. The 1886 revelation, the night of September 26th and 27th, there's a great body of material from fundamentalist sources about this. And Lauren Woolley wrote more than one account about it. And inadvertently, I think, Spencer Kimball has confirmed this controversial revelation, which was to the effect that the law would never be abolished, that is, the law of plural marriage, and this is of God, and it will continue. In April conference, 1978, over national TV, President Kimball said that right at the end of it, he said, in conclusion, I will say that I know that Jesus Christ lives because my predecessor, John Taylor, met him. And the only time that John Taylor claimed that was the night of 26th and 27th of September, 1886. So we have, I'm sure that President Kimball didn't realize, or might be a slip, I don't know, but this is the only time, and I take this as pretty good evidence of the authenticity of that controversial revelation. Bishop Woolley, I don't have any quibble there. I do have a quibble with being charged of inaccuracy. In fact, I think he's inaccurate. Now, we could go to bat on that, but I think you got a little confused on the chronology of Mormon history there.
I got that.
So we're not going to settle that here.
No,
but
no.
Yeah. I realize that a paper about a feud about untouchable people is not going to improve my popularity in Utah. I will also say that you're supposed to put it in 15 pages and you have to more or less get the high spots. Do you have any more questions? He says nothing is suppressed. Well, that might be so. That's the official attitude, but I've been trying for a long time to get the journals of John Taylor, which I know exist, and they won't let me have a look. It's not suppression. They just won't let me have a look.
Let me say on the diaries of John Taylor, there certainly are things in the Vol of First Presidency for Good Cause which have only been used selectively. I wish I knew for certain that the journals of John Taylor were among them. There's no question that they did exist 40 years ago. There's a lot of question about what happened to them since then. There continue to be rumors about there's a volume here with that family member and maybe somebody's heard of it over there. They might be in the First Presidency's vault. Indeed, they might. I don't know. But the family or the church or somebody's got to come up with that sometime because it's tremendously important. And I have had access to notes B.H. Roberts took out of John Taylor's diary that are unpublished in the things that John Taylor, B.H. Roberts wrote. And tremendously insightful and detailed diary entries. It'll be a tremendous asset when somebody comes forth and says, here they've been all these years. But I don't think it's too early to say that somebody over at the First Presidency's office is sitting on that one. I just don't think we know that for certain. If they aren't, let's get some lobbying and get it out. Yes, John? There's no question that there's a lot of sensitivity about what should be used and how it should be used. There's also a lot of misunderstanding about how archives work and that archives have responsibilities to set some limits on copying and some limits on access. And for many years, the reputation of the Historical Department of the Church Historian's Office back then, was you just can't see anything. That wasn't true. Many people got in for years and saw many things. Sam Taylor's brother, Raymond Taylor, spent many years typing day after day with access to virtually all the things in the Historian's Office. I don't think he got everything in Joseph Fielding Smith's vault, and he probably didn't get everything in the First Presidency's vault. But in the historian's office, over the years, he got the access. And I know that because I sat alongside of him while he typed letters day after day, years of typing. People had access back then. But suddenly the perception was, instead of being closed, and that wasn't totally right, then it's all open. And that wasn't totally right either. But we struggle between what is the responsible way to meet the legitimate needs of the institution and the needs of scholarship. We've gone on both sides of that, and now there's pressure to go back to an earlier solution, and we simply haven't arrived at a compromise that's suitable to everyone. It can be done if we can sit down together and communicate, but while we've been yelling at each other in the news media, it's not going to be solved. Whatever is over there has been microfilmed, I'm certain of that, but I haven't had access to an inventory. I have heard rumors, but I've heard other rumors too that didn't turn out to be correct, so that may in fact be the case.
Edwin D. Woolley and John Taylor. Incidentally, there were quotes from the Journal of John Taylor in the latest edition of BYU Studies, and the documentation was TypeScript Lee Library. Well, my sister was down there 2 days ago and they don't know anything about it. somebody saw something.
I'd like to.
Thank you very much.